Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. The U.S. Constitution provides the very foundation of our democracy and has done so for 2.25 centuries. What were the founding framers really thinking? What the framers intended is subject to ongoing debate. Why do we have 3 branches of government, an electoral college? Why did the framers not include a Bill of Rights in the original document? Thanks to meticulous research, we now have a better idea. University of Missouri political scientist Dave Robertson has drawn from a mosaic of primary sources to give us what is probably the clearest picture yet of why the framers did what they did at the Constitutional Convention. It's all detailed in his new book, The Original Compromise, What the Constitution's Framers Were Really Thinking. Dave Robertson joins me in studio. Dave, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Don. Thanks much for the kind words.
Well, congratulations to you. I really enjoyed your book. What a refresher it is for that part of our history.
Oh, thanks.
And the research is just fantastic. Congratulations once again.
Thank you.
You know, and looking at the title, starting with that, The Original Compromise, compromise obviously being a key word. And I kept thinking throughout as I was reading, I wonder if politicians today could pull something like this off.
Well, I think they try to, but right now we're so polarized it's very hard to do. But, you know, we have an example of the way compromise produces some solutions to problems by going to the theater and seeing the movie Lincoln. Mm-hmm. The kind of politicians that got together to enact the 13th or to send the 13th Amendment to the states were a lot like these politicians. There are some good, some bad. I personally like politicians as a group. But they were politicians, and it was their job to try to negotiate different kinds of interests and come up with a solution. That happened at the convention, too.
Well, you mentioned the politics of it, and there's a note I have here in front of me that from the book that you point out that much of what they said and did as politicians was to mask other ambitions during this whole process.
Yeah. You know, there was an author named Charles Beard who talked about the Constitution 100 years ago from a progressive era point of view, talking about how, well, you know, they boosted their sort of economic prospects with this document. And that's been really disproven for the most part over the course of the next 100 years. But even though you can't say that they got an advantage financially from the Constitution, they sure did politically, because almost all of them went on to fill the offices they created, including James Madison, who served as president.
And he keeps coming up again and again and again. I mean, he was a key guy, obviously.
Absolutely. He deserves to be known as the father of the Constitution. We see Madison in our civics books and our textbooks as kind of this elderly person with these paintings from 1821. This was a young man, 36 years old, from the middle of Virginia, where you could look out your porch and see forever. Mm-hmm. It was incredibly optimistic about the future of the country if it could be governed better.
But he was fairly slippery as well. I mean, he had his own agenda, and he established things early on so that they would follow a logical sequence and therefore meet some of his expectations, if I can put it that way, a little more easily.
Yeah, like Alexander Hamilton, he shared a vision of a stronger national government that could help the United States compete on the world stage with all those big powers that already existed. And his ambitions were for a much stronger but also Republican national government, Republican with a small r.
Before we get too far ahead of ourselves, I think what we ought to do is set the stage, as you do in the book. You begin with what's called the setting. What conditions were like at that time? We had the Articles of Confederation. The country was run under these articles at that time. Why was this convention necessary?
It was necessary because the government looked like it was failing. It was meeting less often, fewer people were showing up, but the conditions were as dire as ever. We went through an economic slowdown that was about as serious as the Depression in a lot of ways during the middle of the 1780s. We were starting to come out of it, but there were problems with defending the country. The world's most powerful navy was still floating off the coast, still had forts on American soil. Spain was a threat. There was a threat internally in the states, where there was turmoil in a state like Rhode Island between the landless and creditors.
Yeah, we have to keep in mind this is 1787 we're talking about, not too far removed from the Revolutionary War.
Absolutely not. Yeah. Most of these individuals at the convention had played some part in the Revolutionary War.
Well, what we have are 13 colonies, some large, some small, some north, some south. So you bring all these disparate parts together in Philadelphia to try to forge our Constitution. It was set up to fail, actually, wasn't that?
It was a huge task, almost overwhelming task, not just to find some kind of stronger government, but to find a stronger government that would satisfy somebody like Madison and still make it Republican. That was the key. They had to find a way to make government that was both strong and responsive to the people.
So there were a couple of plans. There was a New Jersey plan. There was a Virginia plan. One took a broader look and the other not quite so broad. Competing plans right from the get-go.
Right from the get-go, the Madison faction, he was trying to build a political coalition of six states behind his plan, developed this Virginia plan, which spelled out proportional representation, that is, the larger the state, the more votes you got, in both houses of Congress. It had much stronger commercial powers than the government we wound up with at the end of the convention. Stronger military powers, and the national government, imagine this, had the power in Madison's plan to veto any law that a state would pass. Imagine how that would have affected us.
Right. And the states obviously very, very mindful of this, and there was a natural competition between states' rights and the federal government.
Right. And that's why Madison tried to put together a coalition of six states by putting first on the agenda a vote for proportional representation in the House and the Senate. If he could get them to pass that, he would get six states behind him for a stronger national government.
Because they were larger states.
That's right. They would have the power to determine what that national government did.
And we'll get to this later, but that came up to be an issue later on when they were talking about other aspects of the Constitution.
Absolutely. The other protagonist in this fight is a guy named Roger Sherman, who is not quite as prominent as Madison. He's not well remembered today. 30 years older than Madison, one of the oldest delegates at the convention from Connecticut. And Connecticut was doing just fine, thank you very much, mm-hmm. and knew that they wanted some stronger powers for the national government, but not strong powers of the way Madison thought strong powers ought to be formed. So Sherman and his allies fought for the smaller states against Madison's coalition. It's not really small against large because Georgia had a tiny population, and New York, which was opposed to Madison, had a pretty big population.
And there were a couple of colonies that weren't represented at all.
Well, New Hampshire didn't get there until midway through the convention. Rhode Island, to the great relief of many of the delegates themselves, never sent delegates to the convention. Because people at the convention would talk about Rhode Island as a bunch of crazies, as people you didn't want to be represented at the convention because they would mess things up.
And that was the first battle, obviously, was the whole idea of representation, the establishment of the House of Representatives,
right.
And then ultimately the Senate. Give us some sense as to how this, the first with the House, how that debate went.
Well, they all knew that there had to be stronger legislative powers, and the real commitment was to a stronger national government. If they were going to commit to a strong central real government, not just a confederation like the United Nations, they knew that the governance had to be more Republican than just the representatives in the Confederation Congress. So they negotiated over a House of Representatives, pretty much came to a conclusion on that, but left the Senate in the background, knowing that there would be two houses of Congress so that they could check each other. And the fight over the House of Representatives turned on how many representatives each state would get. That became a pretty dicey political issue.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the options that they felt they had?
Well, they were pretty much agreed. Even people like Sherman were willing to concede that the House of Representatives would be based on population, not just on each state having an equal set of representatives. They had to be concerned about big states having too many votes, and they had to be concerned about slavery. How do you count slaves when you apportion population? They already had done a little of this during the Confederation in assigning the responsibility for funding the government to states. They had counted slaves as 3/5 of a person, and eventually they broke down and just extended that and put it into the Constitution.
With all the discussion that they had about slavery, it's interesting that the word slavery never appears in the Constitution.
They avoided that word scrupulously. They didn't want to put the word slavery in the Constitution. It would be controversial. They didn't like the idea that slavery existed. But at the in the secrecy of the convention hall, and remember, these were all secret proceedings. We didn't see any of Madison's notes for many years after the convention ended. In the privacy of the convention hall, the debate over slavery was frank, and it was chilling at times.
Yeah. Well, it was that, and again, I was startled to find out that that word was never included in that.
Right.
What about, just to backtrack a moment, to your sourcing? I mean, this book is being promoted as probably having a greater insight into the mindset of the Founding Fathers than anything that's been published yet. What about your sourcing in this?
Most of this is based on the records of the Constitutional Convention, and there are scholars who have looked at how accurate these are. Madison's notes seem to hold up pretty well by all tests. I excluded one set of notes from a delegate named Yates, whose notes were kind of doctored later on to get involved in later politics. But there were some other records. There were letters by delegates. George Washington would write home from time to time. Other delegates would write home. So there's a lot of evidence that we can use, and there's a lot of background information that we can use too.
I'm surprised that scholars didn't precede you in putting all this stuff together.
Well, they have done. There are historians who've written great, wonderful histories of the Constitutional Convention that tend to go in sequence. This book doesn't do that. It looks at topics and it tries to figure out specifically what it is the framers were thinking. What are these guys thinking when they come up with a House of Representatives and a Senate, presidency, and the Electoral College of all things?
The Electoral College. We'll talk about that after a break that's coming up. I'll take that break now so we can get into that, because that's a fascinating part of it and certainly part of the big discussion today. Mm-hmm. Again, as you point out in your book, I believe I'm correct on this, that no issue has been the subject of more proposed constitutional amendments than the Electoral College.
That's correct.
All right. We'll talk about that when we come back. My guest is Dave Robertson, a political scientist. His book is The Original Compromise, what the Constitution's framers were really thinking. I think the title of the book is self-explanatory. We'll come back and continue our conversation. We certainly want to bring you into it if you have questions about the Constitutional Convention. And keep in mind that the Bill of Rights was not decided at the convention. That came a couple of years later. So we will not be necessarily getting into those issues. But if you have questions, give us a call, 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on Air. You can reach us through Facebook. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation with Dave Robertson, University of Missouri St. Louis political scientist and the author of The Original Compromise, What the Constitution's Framers Were Really Thinking. And we're talking about the 1787 Constitutional Convention and what went on there. Dave has done an awful lot of research to get into the minds of these gentlemen. We were just talking off the air about the intellectual firepower present at that convention. What a room that must have been.
What experience. You know, these people had helped guide a dozen infant republics through the worst things you could imagine, a war and then a terrible depression. And they had built the governments so that they would do things that are basic to government that are hard to do, like taxing people.
Yeah. The fact that these guys got together and had this firepower that I'm talking of, I wonder about personal jealousies, personal animosities. What do we see along these lines? I didn't see much in the book. Obviously, they debated, but you didn't see much of the vicious, malicious stuff.
Yeah, one of the limitations of using those records that we have are that they're a little less personal than you might like. I'm sure there were a lot of conversations that I would love to have heard at the inns after the convention recessed, different things that people said on walks and on rides in the country. It would be great to have an ear on these things, but we don't have it.
We want to talk about the Electoral College, but we were talking about sourcing a moment ago.
Uh-huh.
We already have a call from Ed, who is bringing up one of the key sources of information for you. So let's bring him into the conversation. Ed, go ahead. You're on the air.
The professor was talking about Madison, and I know he was one of the writers of the Federalist Papers, even though he didn't say he was, you know, they use pseudonyms, I guess. But my question is, there must have been the anti-Federalists. Federalist Papers. You know, it's like taking, you know, like fair and balanced relative to Fox News, fair and balanced. And who were the anti-Federalists? Because I would just guess, one of them probably was Jefferson, who, you know, I'm just guessing, would have said, yeah, let's do states' rights more, you know, kind of, sort of. Now, who were the anti-Federalists? Because you hear our Congress people quote the Federalists, they're only taking one side of the argument, you know. Or, you with me?
I am with you. And I think that's a great question. It's really a two-part question. What about the Federalist Papers? And what about the people who didn't like the Constitution that was produced? I'm trying to explain the document that came out of that convention and that got ratified by the states and went into effect. So even though the Federalists raised a lot of claims and helped push Madison and others to put forward a Bill of Rights, I'm really talking about that original document before the Bill of Rights comes along. When I talk about sources, there are a lot of great histories of the events at the convention and the chronology of who said what, when, where. I'm trying to get deeper than that and work from the House of Representatives, for example, or the Senate or the Electoral College, and try to ask these guys and look at their documents to ask, what were you thinking when you came to that conclusion, when you came to that agreement? The Federalist Papers are great because they were written by Madison, Hamilton, and John Jay to help push support for the Constitution and its ratification in the state of New York after they had written the Constitution. Hamilton and Madison were there. John Jay was not. But the Federalist Papers, and this really sort of gets me going a little bit, that the Federalist Papers are just not a reliable source of information on what the framers were thinking. One of the reasons I wrote this book was the increasing use of the Federalist Papers, both by people in government and on both sides, and by people outside of government saying, well, this is what the framers meant. It's not what they meant. The Federalist Papers hardly ever talk about slavery. But slavery was critical to this convention. The Federalist Papers don't say anything about the possibility of a national government veto of state laws. But that was dear to Madison's heart, and he was frustrated thinking that the government might not work very well without it. There are other great examples of things that the Federalist Papers say, including Madison, saying things that he would have almost laughed at the Constitutional Convention. Meanwhile, he was writing to Jefferson, who supported the Constitution, though with some reluctance, and trying to explain to Jefferson how disappointed he was with the way this all turned out. Jefferson was on the side of ratification, but he didn't like some of the powers and provisions in the Constitution.
And Jefferson, of course, wasn't present. He was in France.
Right. He was in France.
Yeah. How much did they draw upon the Articles of Confederation for the work that they did there? Did they just totally disavow that?
Pretty much they started from scratch and said, we need a strong central government. And they came to that agreement right in the first couple of days. Mm-hmm. They came to an agreement that there should be a bicameral legislature, a two-house legislature. Almost everybody agreed, including the authors of the New Jersey Plan, there ought to be an executive at the national level and a court. So that much of the plan was pretty much agreed on by everybody there.
The devil was in the details,
oh, absolutely,
as is so often the case.
Absolutely.
We have an email here from Andy in St. Louis to continue the most recent line of thinking here. As revolutionary thinkers in their own time, did the framers believe that the Constitution they were composing would last indefinitely into the future, or did they believe that it might someday have to be rewritten? It seems to me that today we view the Constitution as a timeless document, but what did the framers think about its future application?
Well, they certainly provided for amendments, so they knew it could be changed. They probably didn't anticipate some of the changes we made, but they certainly knew that it could be changed, except for one thing. Every state gets the same number of senators in the U.S. Senate, whether it was Delaware then against Virginia or Delaware today against California. Same number of senators. But as for longevity, some didn't think it would last very long. Some really didn't know how long it would last before being changed. It really wasn't in their experience for a written constitution to last for an indefinite period. This is a time when to change governments, you'd have to decapitate a king or to expel him from the country. One of the great landmarks, one of the great hallmarks of this constitution is that we've had so many peaceful transitions of powers without having some kind of bloody riots to bring changes of leadership into existence.
And the changes come at times when there's been plenty of emotion.
Absolutely.
Needless to say. We have another email here I'd like to bring in now. What is new in your book that is most pertinent to today's national debate in which all players spout off about the Constitution? We make demigods of the founders and find such disparate conclusions to guide us in supporting modern applications of the principles embodied in the founding document.
I'd say two things. One is real human politicians, not philosophers, not angels, not, thank goodness, political scientists, wrote the Constitution. And they wrote it as a rule book for the future play of politics. They trusted, or at least allowed, for politicians in the future to make substantive decisions about what the United States would do with this power. But they never thought that they were spelling out all the details about the boundaries of the power of the House or the Senate or the states or the federal government. They wouldn't have thought that. They created a contested field based on a bunch of ambiguous terms like necessary and proper, general welfare.
I was just looking at my notes here. You write that the framers utilized intentional ambiguity.
Absolutely, just like the authors of lots of legislation over the course of American history.
What are the most conspicuous ambiguities? You just gave one example.
Necessary and proper. They knew they were going to have to add some powers, and even Roger Sherman, who was reluctant to concede power, said, well, all right, we need some kind of elastic clause. That was one. You know, the battle over a standing army, many of them, like Elbridge Gerry, wanted to limit the standing army. They would be shocked at the size of the military today. He wanted to limit the size of the army to 2,000 or 3,000 troops. And, you know, that didn't sound very reasonable, even in 1787. George Washington supposedly said, well, let's also add a provision that nobody can invade us with more than 3,000 troops.
You know, it also brings to my mind, at least, raising the issue of original intent and how easy or complicated it would be today to try to determine what original intent really was.
Yeah, there's different ways to try to do that, to see what common meaning of words is. But these are politicians, and I mean that in a good way, just like you would look at Abraham Lincoln as a politician. And they were designing words intentionally to have some flexibility because they couldn't cover all of the possible contingencies. And even if they could, they could never agree on what it was that the government actually ought to do with some specific powers.
You know, a moment ago we were asked about longevity and how long the framers thought the Constitution would last. I was trying to think of Ben Franklin's quote, the day that when the Constitutional Convention ended and a woman stopped him and asked him pretty much that question. I've forgotten exactly how he responded. Do you recall?
Well, this is a question about the sun on a chair in the at the convention. He saw a sun rising on a chair or setting and said, well, that's got to be a rising sun. Now, outside the convention, a woman asked Franklin, what kind of government have we got? And he said, a Republican, if you can keep it.
If you can keep it. That being the word I was trying to come up with. All right, back to the phones. Ben in Clayton, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you very much. Sounds like an extremely interesting book, and I intend to get it.
It is a good book.
I wonder if you could comment on the various provisions in the Constitution that the Southern states demanded, perhaps as a condition of signing the Constitution, with respect to slavery, like Section 9, no changes until 1808, and the provision on fugitive slaves and the like.
Right. Those three things, we've already mentioned the Three-Fifths Compromise that gave the South more representatives in the House of Representatives than they might have had if slaves weren't counted. And there were bitter, nasty fights over how much representation to give the South. They, of course, wanted slaves counted fully, one for one in setting population. They also were very concerned about the North having the power to end the slave trade because they were concerned about the way commercial powers would be used. So when it was clear that the South, the Southern states in Madison's coalition, were not going to get proportional representation in the Senate, they started to float the idea, well, we need to have a huge majority for any of these treaties you guys want to make with Britain or with France or others to trade agricultural goods because you could design treaties that would hurt our region. We don't want that. So if you want to have those treaties and make them easy to pass, we want protection for the slave trade because two of the states, South Carolina and Georgia, depended on importing slaves for the wealth of their states. Virginia and North Carolina, not so much, but those two far southern states. Great concern to the framers because if those states decide not to come into the Union, they could align with a Spain or a Britain and threaten the south end of the American Confederation. Fugitive slaves, slaves are the only form of property that it can will to get up and leave. So they wanted to make sure that their property would be protected wherever it went.
And if representation were based on wealth, then that would be a distinct advantage to the South because
absolutely,
if the slaves were counted, regardless of how they were counted,
right,
they were counted as well.
Right. As the framers and others have discovered, it's really, really hard to decide how you're going to count wealth. And it's so full of political landmines that it's just better to go with population.
I have another email here I'm going to read. Rich in Belleville writes, I frequently hear claims that the Constitution is a Christian and religious-based document founded on Christian principles. I'd like to hear your thoughts on the origins of the Christian Constitution myth and the motivation for perpetuating it. I think it is very damaging to our history to distort who these people were and how they came up with this fascinating document.
I'd say that religious principles did not enter into the Constitutional Convention very much. As you would expect, they don't enter into debates in Congress either now or in the 1860s. At one point, Ben Franklin said, well, maybe we're at such an impasse we need a clergyman to come in and give a benediction every morning. And Alexander Hamilton said, well, that would just signal people outside that we're in desperate shape. We don't want to send that signal, so let's not do it. And it just sort of let go.
You know, we went to that first break talking about the Electoral College and haven't gotten back to it. Let's do that now so folks who are waiting for it aren't disappointed. How in the world did we come up with this idea?
Well, Madison himself said, I hadn't really given a lot of great thought to what we're going to do with this executive. We know we want one, but we don't know who's going to choose them. And remember, for these guys, who chooses you tells you how they're going to behave because it's who you're beholden to. For most of the convention, a lot of the delegates wanted Congress, as originally proposed in the Virginia plan, wanted Congress to choose the president. Well, you can imagine that that was going to be not entirely a happy circumstance. And once the Senate was settled as equal state representation, Madison and Hamilton and the others said, we need a more independent president than we're going to have. So we need to fight for an alternative. While Congress was assuming that Congress would choose the president, during the convention, an alternative plan was developed based on some separate group of people who would not be members of Congress who would choose the president. That's where the germ of the Electoral College came from.
It's kind of a Rube Goldberg
well, it seems like
contraption.
Yeah. It's meant to avoid having Congress do it.
Sure, because they didn't want the president to be beholden. And
that's right.
And bring the politics. Bring the politics.
Well, then make the president subordinate to Congress.
Yeah. The term of office for the president was something that was widely debated, and it went all the way from a very short period of time to a lifetime appointment.
Right. There were some, including a delegate from Virginia that Madison really liked, who suggested a term of office much like the judges, you know, for good behavior, as long as you want. Gouverneur Morris, one of the most enjoyable characters at the convention, supported that idea. But as things went along, other delegates like Sherman wanted a short leash on the president. As they went along, they sort of settled on a 4-year term because they already decided on a 2-year term for the House, a 6-year term for the Senate. The 4-year term seemed both reasonable and seemed to set the president apart from the other two parts of Congress.
And of course, there was no limitation on the number of terms at that particular point.
These politicians at the Constitutional Convention said the best way to keep politicians in check is to make sure that they're always aware that they can be defeated in the next election. They shot down term limits for people in the House of Representatives and for the president.
I wonder if they came back today and looked at where we are today, and I don't mean just the polarization issue in Washington,
yeah,
but how this document has survived and the way it's applied today. I wonder if they would be happy. Not happy? What do you think?
I think they'd love some things and hate others. The prosperity of the country is they'd revel in it, in the amount of wealth that the United States has generated. They would be appalled, I think, at the size of the military. That was something even the people who were military veterans did not want to last. A standing army would have been a serious problem for any of them. And to have a large standing army like this, remember, this was a time when people in other countries used the military to defeat their political enemies. So they were naturally concerned about that. I think they would be surprised at the degree to which people are treated equally, particularly African Americans in the country. They would be amazed, I think, at the degree to which rights have expanded to women. Women did not figure into this at all. I don't have much in this because their women were not really mentioned at all at the Constitutional Convention.
And yet there are a number of fascinating books out there, and Okokie Roberts has one of them, on the women of the time and how influential they were behind the scenes at home, as is so often the case.
They were tremendously influential, and one of the great stories in American history is the way women have found avenues for influence despite the fact that they were excluded from this.
Yeah. There were women's rights groups in the 1700s, late 1700s, very, very active and very influential.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dave Robertson is our guest. The book is The Original Compromise, What the Constitution's Framers Were Really Thinking. We'll come back and find out what Dave is really thinking about a number of other issues he's included in his book. We'll do that in just a moment. And, of course, we want your calls and emails. 382-8255 is the number. Email talk at stlpublicradio.org. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back to our conversation with Dave Robertson, UMSL political scientist and the author of the book we're talking about today, The Original Compromise, What the Constitution's Framers Were Really Thinking. Before we continue that conversation, I'd like to offer this programming note. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll be spending an hour with NPR social media strategist Andy Carvin. We'd like input from social media on that show, so get your comments and questions ready and be ready to tweet at STL on Air. You can also reach us through Facebook. So Andy Carvin will be talking social media and NPR's strategy for utilizing it tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air. I'd like to take one moment to go to page 124 of your book, Dave, because there's just a sentence here that made me think that life back in 1787 was not a whole heck of a lot different than it is today. Many of delegates objected to any popular election of the executive. Charles Pinckney worried that the people would be led by a few active and designing men. And to me, that bespeaks the big donors in today's thank you to the U.S. Supreme Court and recent rulings with regard to big money people getting involved in the act.
Yeah. Remember, some of these delegates were leaders of political factions in their states, and there were other factions that opposed them. When they write about factions in the Federalist Papers, they know what they're talking about. There are demagogues in lots of different states. They're worried about what those demagogues can do when they lead the people, as they did in Rhode Island, to pass laws that hurt creditors. That's something they don't want, and they're concerned about that from start to finish.
They are also concerned about majorities, that the majorities in many cases could be a real problem.
Absolutely. they needed to design a stronger national government that was Republican. But in Republican government, as they could see in their own states, majorities rule. Well, they didn't want them to rule and make mistakes. So this is the big problem. How do you create a strong national government that doesn't screw up, where you let the people decide things, but sort of figure out a way to mitigate some of the mistakes they're likely to make? That was a huge challenge.
What a fascinating time. I keep coming back to that, this room with these people making these decisions.
Yeah.
And so well thought out. They were also very visionary. They saw the growing of the country. They saw the West and the role that new states would inevitably come into the picture.
Right, and that was worrisome to some of them. There was a considerable amount of support for writing a constitution that would guarantee that the 13 original states would control and dominate Congress forever. And we came very close. There was a vote on a 5-4 vote by the states to allow new states to come in on the same terms as old states. But, boy, that was close. There were a lot of close calls like that in this convention. It could have gone in different ways.
And, of course, they had to resolve early on how these votes would be counted state by state, or the population of states,
right,
and where they should be weighed differently. It was very complicated.
Right, yeah. Right.
Let's take another call. Ken in Creve Coeur, thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Hey, as great as this topic is and as thorough as your book is, I have a feeling it probably didn't cover my favorite topic about it, and that is the Founding Fathers' pretty clear views on what the nature of our money should be, our monetary system. Many of the founders back then turned to Roger Sherman, who you mentioned before,
mm-hmm.
He said this is a favorable crisis for crushing paper money. Clearly, their view was to keep us on a gold and silver basis, not to have legal tender paper notes. And speaking of some terms in the Constitution that might be ambiguous or with some wiggle room, and there certainly are those, they were pretty explicit when it came to money. They said no state shall emit bills of credit, no state shall coin money or make anything but gold and silver coin of tender in payment of debt. And then the Congress itself shall coin money, fix the standards of weights and measures, and punish for counterfeiting. So Roger Sherman even wrote a book about it, A Caveat Against Injustice, The Evils of a Fluctuating Medium of Exchange. And other founding fathers at the time, it seemed like, regardless of perhaps its contemporary application today, at least their legislative intent regarding our monetary system, I would think, would be pretty clear and amazing and surprising considering what we're doing today.
I guess I would disagree with that a little bit. I understand the point that you're making, and I think they would agree that there should be a stable monetary system and that there shouldn't be some of the things we've talked about with inflation and other kinds of games with monetary policy. But note, it is absolutely clear that the framers did not want the states to print paper money. It was a crisis that they were facing, part of the crisis that they faced in their neighboring states, Rhode Island borders, Connecticut. It was a problem for Connecticut too. But where's the language that bans paper money printing by the federal government? You won't find it in there because they didn't want to hamstring the government that way. They felt that the national government, under terms of stress, as during the Revolution, was potentially going to need a more flexible source of credit and money, and they refused to ban it.
Well, they did it indirectly by binding the states to gold and silver coin as a tender in payment of debt, and yet in the same sentence they said they can't coin money. Where are they going to get it? Well, the federal government was, in Article 1, Section 8, says that they could coin money, fix the standards of weights and measures. So I think clearly the statements by Roger Sherman in his book and others was that they indirectly wanted to bind the federal government by that prohibition upon the states.
Okay. Well, we disagree on that because I don't see the evidence.
Ken, thank you so much for the call. Ken, I recognize Ken's voice. I haven't heard from him in a long time, but this is generally the subject that we'll bring him to the program, and we're glad you're here, Ken. Let's take another call here. Bob in Millstadt, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I'd like you to address more thoroughly the idea that the Constitution was a secular document. I think the states at the time had constitutions that required people to be Christian or could not be Jewish or Catholic or other religions. And I think that the Constitution was specifically written as a godless constitution, secular document.
Well, I think they left out controversy. There's a lot of different ways to interpret the reason that God was not included in the text of the Constitution. It wasn't mentioned very much. There was a good deal of contention over religion in the United States then, as there is now. And Madison in particular, Madison deserves to be seen as one of the heroes of religious liberty in the United States. He had already fought to ensure religious liberty in his own state and was continuing to do that along with Jefferson. And Madison wanted to leave these kinds of things out of the calculus for developing government. Remember, some states, including Sherman's Connecticut, had established churches. They required funding for one established church. That was going to erode over time, but it wasn't gone yet.
Thanks so much for the call, Bob. We'll take another one here. Matt in St. Louis. Go ahead. You're on the air with Dave Robertson.
Good morning. Recently, NPR talked about how a Missouri law was struck down because it superseded a federal law. Is that something that was part of Madison's plan?
Madison originally wanted Congress, which he meant the sort of national legislative authority, to have the power to veto any state law, to strike it down when it was in conflict in any way with national law. That was one of his original plans. The supporters of the New Jersey plan, Madison's opponents, fought that. They defeated it, but almost immediately said, let's give the courts some ability to fight laws that are bad for the national interest by making national law supreme. This is the supremacy clause, another kind of an ambiguous clause, but nevertheless, it gives courts pretty specifically the power to strike down laws that violate the laws passed at the national level.
That was just imposed yesterday,
yes,
here in Missouri,
right,
with
right.
regard to the contraception issue.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay, we thank you so much for that call. Let's take in Charles calling from Chesterfield. Charles, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
I'd like to defend the Electoral College. For me, it's the most profoundly good part of the Constitution, as the three-fifths clause is the most profoundly bad part of the Constitution. And the Electoral College brings the power of the vote, the single vote, down to a more local level. And my question, and by the way, I would think that the concept should be severely thought about today in terms of bringing it down as far as the precinct level. So I have a question, which is, isn't winner take all, isn't that likely to be unconstitutional, since it allows the politicians to tell the electors who to vote for? Thank you.
No, because the more fundamental principle in the Electoral College is that states get to decide how they're going to allocate electoral votes. If the legislature just wants to name people, it can do that. As the case of Bush versus Gore in 2000 specified, states choose how electors are chosen. And most of the states have decided on this winner-take-all system where the parties in advance have chosen electors, and whoever wins a majority, a plurality of the vote in the state, his party electors cast the electoral votes for him.
We thank you for the call. You know, we've talked about two branches of the government so far, the executive and the legislative, not in as much detail as you do in your book. But we haven't talked much about the judiciary.
Yeah.
And that certainly was an important component and not, again, not an easy one to wrestle with.
No. A lot of these participants were lawyers. Some were judges. Sherman was a judge. And wanted to make sure that the courts could act as a kind of a barrier to bad things that the rest of government could do. So they sort of drifted without talking about it greatly. This is not a long chapter in the book because there's not a lot on it. But they drifted toward giving the judiciary more independent power than they probably thought it might have at the beginning of the convention, just because, you know, Sherman would fight to increase the Senate's powers and others would fight to increase the House's powers. Madison would fight to increase the president's powers. Well, everybody wanted to beef up their institution. The courts could be a backdrop, an umpire, to help create a kind of a extra protection for the different interests that they were concerned about.
What about the Supreme Court? How was that handled?
The Supreme Court was going to be, for some of them, like Sherman, the only court that would exist. There would be no federal courts. There was lots of opposition to having any inferior courts. And the number of members on the Supreme Court was not specified. The appointment would be by the president, as Madison would have wanted, but confirmation by the Senate, as Sherman wanted. It's almost like this kind of Gulliver's Travels presidency, where you've got this big, giant potential power tied down by a million strings in the United States Senate.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I wonder about is the fact that although they discussed many of the issues that were ultimately included in the Bill of Rights, which were ratified in 1791, why didn't they deal with these issues during the Constitutional Convention? They talked about a lot of them.
I'd say there's a couple of reasons. One is they were just tired out at the end of the convention, and they were grateful to have something written, because there were points at which you wondered if people were going to walk out and ruin the whole enterprise after all the time they put into it. It was also very controversial because some said, look, if we even say that the national government can repress free speech or the press, that will imply that this federal government has some kind of monstrous powers, and just saying that will fuel those who want to kill the Constitution when it goes to ratification. They did put in some things. Habeas corpus, which has been a big issue over the last several years, they wanted to ensure that. They wanted to make sure that you would be that you would be able to have your time in court in an independent way, have your case judged. They were trying to solve problems that they had seen in English history, with which they were very familiar.
And yet, had they dealt with some of these issues, and I'm thinking of the First and Second Amendment in particular right now, we might know more today about original intent, which is such a point of controversy today.
We might, although, remember that there were plenty of provisions in the U.S. Constitution that weren't all that clear. So I'm not sure they were going to come up with anything that much more clear in their deliberations.
What most impressed you about all of this, Dave, after all of the research that you did? What did you take away from it all?
First, that these were very human people who did a great job under terrible circumstances. You know, not only was it hot in Philadelphia, it was a disease-ridden port. These were in some cases elderly people who were worried about how well they were going to hold up under this, and they stuck it out. They stuck it out when they lost their opportunity to get what they wanted. Madison didn't leave. Sherman didn't leave. They didn't get all they wanted. Some said it was better than nothing. They weren't terribly happy with it, but they stuck it out and compromise formed the Constitution. Compromise allowed them to sign it. We have to live with that and make compromise the center of governing now.
We only have a little over a minute left. One name that hasn't been mentioned during our discussion here, but who is certainly very present there and subsequently, is George Washington.
Right.
What about his role in the convention?
Washington was a Virginian, a friend of Madison, and Madison wanted Washington there, thinking, well, you know, he'll certainly be an important force for moving this forward. He was clearly in favor of strong national powers. His very presence as the president of the convention, which didn't allow him to speak very much, allowed him to keep more order, keep personal comments down a little bit, keep some of the backbiting you might see in Congress down to a minimum, and help guide the convention toward sticking together to keep a solution on the table so that something would get done.
And it was a foregone conclusion, and again, only a couple of seconds left. No matter what they decided with regard to the executive or the president or the term, that he was going to be the guy.
It sure looks like it from a couple of comments at the Constitutional Convention.
Yeah. Dave Robertson, our guest. What a great hour, Dave.
Thank you.
So appreciative that you're here to talk about the book, and I loved it. The Original Compromise, What the Constitution's Framers Were Really Thinking. Just out and available where all good books are sold.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dave Robertson. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, as we mentioned, we'll talk with NPR social media strategist Andy Carvin. So be prepared to weigh in with your tweets at STL on Air. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.